In chapter 15, we had just finished the discussion on the letter that was going to be sent out to the Gentile churches in a reassurance that they were not being called to keep the law as some of the Judean teachers had told them. He does give them four, it's interesting, he gives them four specific things that they are supposed to abstain from. And there's, it's kind of odd when we read them, because when you look at what they're told to do, it says they are told to abstain from things that are sacrificed to idols, things that are from drinking blood, from eating things that have been strangled, and from sexual immorality. And as you look at that list, is there any particular reason you think that they would need to single out sexual immorality here? Why, you would think that that would be a pretty obvious choice, right? That's what the apostles were teaching that wherever they go. Why does he specifically single this out and not so many other different sins that that he could have mentioned here?
Well, when you think about geographical context, mm-hmm. where they were, mm-hmm. the Gentiles' minds had been so polluted by a depraved sense of what was sexually pure, mm-hmm. that they needed to have a new standard introduced to them, and that's why he's burning them on.
Yeah, I suspect that's a big part of it. You know, it would almost be like today, if nobody had ever heard of Jesus today, and we had to go into this culture, for us to talk about sexual immorality would be just, people would look at you like you're crazy. What are you talking about? This is just who we are. It's just a part of life. That's just, it's what kids do when they get old enough. That's what we do. It's just, it's good. It's, you know, there's no idea that this could possibly be impure. This is a pretty strong thing that they're having to change in the Gentile world. And now there's another aspect to that too, that when you look at these other things, for the most part, you're looking at things that probably were associated with idol worship and things that are tangential to idol worship. The idea of obviously eating meat sacrificed to idols, from blood, things that are strangled. You know, these were dietary considerations, and a lot of them had to do with the different connections that are made between idol worship and really everyday life in the Gentile world. You know, if you go back and watch some of the archaeological clips, if you go to Appian Way, they've got a lot of really good stuff on this. And it talks about the culture that they were in places like Ephesus and Philippi, where idol worship was literally interwoven into every aspect of your life. There's just nothing you could do that didn't have some sort of connection to this. You know, what you ate, where you went, who you did business with, all these things in a lot of ways were tied up in these things. And so it seems like what they're doing here is talking specifically about some areas that might have been specifically touched with this idea of idolatry and association with idolatry. Paul talks a lot about this, and I thought about going into this, but we'll save that if we study Corinthians. We'll talk about what Paul says when he talks about eating meat offered to idols. But to sum up what he says in 1 Corinthians, it's basically one, it's not wrong in and of itself, but don't do it anyway because you might cause someone to stumble and embolden their weak conscience. And two, maybe it's not inherently wrong, but here's some really good reasons why you ought not to be engaged in it. Because it's tangential, it's connected to that idea of idolatry, and you're associating yourself by doing this when you knowingly partake in these things. Even if they're not wrong in and of themselves, you're putting yourself in a position to be associated with evil. And that's when he says, what communion has dark with light, or with God with Belial? And he goes through all these lists of things. This is an association you don't want to have. And so there's a reminder to the Gentiles that they need to be separate from the world. They need to be pure. They need to be cutting off these ties to idolatry. And one other thing quickly about that, because James gives us a reason for why he says this up in verse 21, for he says, from ancient generations, Moses has had in every city those who proclaim him, for he has read every Sabbath in the synagogue. In other words, everywhere you go, when you're going to be establishing these churches, you're going to have Jew and Gentile together. And they're going to have to be able to coexist. They're going to have to be at peace with each other. And you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the Jews needing to accommodate the Gentiles and saying, you can't be imposing the law on them. You can't be forcing them or compelling them to live as Jews, as Paul tells Peter. But on the other hand, he also says you Gentiles shouldn't be flaunting your liberty on the Jews. You need to be making sure that you're not putting stumbling blocks in the way and you're living in a way that you can be at peace with each other. And so that's really a big part again, and we'll see these in, as you go into the letters, and specifically in Romans and Galatians, where Paul talks about this idea of how these two different groups are going to live together and coexist together. So they're going to bring this letter out, and they're going to bring it along with them as we're going to read and share the information with the churches that they're going to see. And as they prepare to do this, Paul and Barnabas are going to go out, and Paul makes a suggestion in verse 36, let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord, to see how they are. And the intention most likely is to bring this letter and say, this is what we're giving you for encouragement. Now, what happens? What's the stumbling block that occurs at this point? Paul and Barnabas have a disagreement. And by the way, that's a... it's not just a disagreement. This apparently is a sharp disagreement. In fact, the word that's used there, it's translated in Jeremiah 32 in the Septuagint as a great indignation, and it's used to describe how God cast the Israelites out of the land. This is not just we're going to agree to disagree. This is there's some real anger involved in this, or at least it seems to be in this context. And why is this dispute so harsh? What's going on? What's the nature of this dispute?
Has it to do with
Mark? Yeah, it has to do with Mark. Let's get more specific. What about Mark? What's Paul's problem with Mark?
Well, previously, Mark had separated from them.
Okay. Okay, so he withdrew. In fact, we talked about this real briefly, and I said I didn't have time to talk about John Mark then, but we'll talk about him now a little bit more. He gets to this section of the first journey, and he turns back, and we're not told why. There's some speculation about it. One, he might be hesitant about taking the gospel to the Gentiles. I don't know if that's true. Some have suggested that the road that they were going to take up into these parts of Galatia is just a dangerous road and a difficult road. And he just may have said, I just can't do this. We know about John Mark, by the way. If you remember, we were introduced to him in chapter 12. Who is his mother? Do you remember? We didn't really read too much in Acts chapter 12, but you remember the story. Peter is in jail, and after he gets out, where does he go? He goes to Mary's house. Now, there's a lot of Marys in the Bible. We don't, whether this is a Mary that's mentioned in the gospel, we don't know. But we do know that she is the mother of John Mark. Or John, who is called Mark, I should say. And if you'll notice, we see a couple of things about this house when Peter goes there. One, there's a gate to the house. Two, who answers the gate when Peter knocks on the door? Yeah, Rhoda, the servant girl. So we already know something about John Mark's family, don't we? These are people of means. Enough to have a servant, enough to have a pretty, let's say elaborate, but a solid structure to their home that probably wouldn't have been present with a lot of Jews in Jerusalem at that time. So we've got someone that is a person of means. Maybe it will be that John just was not ready emotionally or mentally or physically for the rigors of this journey. But for whatever reason, he turns back. And Paul and Barnabas are going to have a dispute about this. Now, why does Barnabas, there's a couple of reasons why. Why does Barnabas want to bring John Mark with him? I think we can assume a couple of things. It isn't stated, but what do we know about Barnabas? What does his name mean? Remember when we were first introduced to him? Son of encouragement. Here's someone whose very identity is wrapped up in building people up. You think Barnabas might have looked at John and said, you know what? He needs a second chance. He'll do better. I want to bring him along. He's going to be all right this time. Now, he has a second chance. There's a second connection, right? What is Barnabas' relationship to John Mark? Do you remember? It may not have mentioned it in Acts yet, but in Colossians 4, when he's mentioned, I believe it's Colossians 4, it mentions Paul refers to John Mark or Mark as the cousin of Barabbas. So there's a relationship there. There is some flesh and blood there. So Barnabas may have had a soft spot in his heart for Mark, and so he wants to bring him along. Barnabas is the cousin of Mark. And of course, cousin can mean different things. It might have been close relation. There's different ways that can be attributed. But so there's a blood relationship there too. Paul is adamantly refusing to do this. And we're not, again, other than the fact that knowing Paul, I mean, when you think about Paul and the expectations he had for his own work, Paul's not somebody who strikes me as being willing to put up and wait for somebody who's going to waffle. He wants people who are all in. And so Paul's just, I'm not doing this. And the divide becomes so strong that Barnabas takes John Mark and goes off to Cyprus, where they had started their first journey. And Paul then is going to go up by land up through some of those first churches in Galatia that he had mentioned. And basically, it's kind of one interesting how God works even in our mistakes. You know, I think sometimes we'll go to this passage and say, "Well, okay, was Barnabas right or was Paul right?" I don't know the answer to that. I mean, they both have different reasons. I think what you could probably argue that is, in the long run, Barnabas probably was right, but Paul is thinking about what we need to do right now. And so I don't know that we can stay one way or the other, but what we do know is that this disagreement between two honorable men results in God's work being done.
Doubly.
Because now Barnabas handles Cyprus, Paul handles Galatia, and all those churches get visited. And so the work gets done. Laura, did you have something? Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about, there's two other people that we're introduced to here. Really quickly, you may have noticed this in Acts 15. When the letter is sent back from Jerusalem to Antioch, do you remember who comes with it? We have Paul and Barnabas coming back to Antioch, and who is with them? There's two men that are mentioned. Judas and Silas. Let's talk about Judas first. Do you notice his surname? Judas called Barsabbas. Does that name sound familiar? Where have we seen that name in the book of Acts already? We have to go all the way back to chapter 1 here. He is the forgotten guy. If you remember in Acts chapter 1, they're trying to replace the apostles and they have two candidates. We all remember Matthias because he's the one that they got picked. Nobody remembers the one that didn't get picked. And his name was what? Joseph, which is called Barsabbas. So most people will probably believe, and I think this is probably a safe assumption, that means that Joseph and Judas were probably brothers. So what we've got here is two men that are coming up that are notable in Jerusalem, one of whom most likely had been with Jesus during his ministry and had been along. I think it's safe to say that if the two brothers probably were both disciples in the early days and certainly had been from the beginning. And then you see Silas, who is called a prophet. So these are men of very high regard in the Lord's church. And they've been brought up as witnesses to this letter. I always like what you'll notice about Paul, especially in his writings. He does this especially in Corinth. Everything that he does and everything that the brethren do is always done with the intent of being above board and transparent and careful to make sure that everything is supported. You know, we're going to write you a letter, and we're not only going to write and send you a letter, but we're going to send you two witnesses to that letter who can testify verbally that all these things in the letter is exactly what happened. So there's a lot of care being taken here to make sure that Antioch gets the full picture and that they are appropriately encouraged. And we see Silas and Judas, when they come, they also are prophets. They, in verse 32, encourage and strengthen the brothers with many words. And by the way, you might notice, does anybody here have verse 34 in their Bible? Some of you probably do. If you're reading the ESV, you don't. Okay, you got it. I think the New American Standard, probably the New King James, probably does. What does that say? Anybody have that?
However, it seemed good to Silas to remain there.
Okay. Okay, the reason that that's not in the ESV, it's not in most of the older manuscripts, and most people have decided that probably what happened was that a scribe put that in as a reference. Now, why would it be important for a scribe to point out that, oh, Silas actually stayed in Antioch? Because what's going to happen with Silas here in a few minutes? Yeah, he's going with Paul. You know, the verse earlier says that they departed back to Jerusalem, and that makes it sound as if, well, Silas and Judas went on to Jerusalem, and well, how's Paul taking Silas on with him? Well, that the reason is because Silas apparently decided to stay behind in Antioch and continue working there. So when it comes time to make this trip, Paul takes Silas with him. And we might know Silas by a different name. It might be kind of odd to us that we never read about Silas in any of Paul's epistles, but we do read about somebody else, and that is the man Silvanus. You may be familiar with him a little bit more. He is the one who is mentioned as being with Paul in the Thessalonian letters. He is the one who also writes the Thessalonian letters for Paul. And actually, he also writes one more letter. In fact, he also writes 1 Peter 5 when Peter says, by Silvanus. So here's a man who becomes very active in the work, obviously, with Paul and his work. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into talking about the Thessalonican time. But also with Peter, there's going to be a point apparently where you've got Paul and Peter and Silas and a number of people all in Rome together, working together. You know, I think sometimes it's funny that you'll hear people a lot of times that will talk about Peter and Paul as being in opposition to each other, that they were somehow like, not adversaries necessarily, but maybe rivals for control in the church. You even hear some people that will make the argument that Peter was the early leader of the church and then Paul came on the scene and kind of took over. And they will use that to say, well, that's why really the church started to emphasize more about grace. Peter didn't talk as much about grace as Paul did. And it's almost as if they'll say that doctrine has kind of been shifted because of Paul. But when we see Paul's relationship with Peter, especially when we get to the end, you remember when Peter mentions Paul in one of his letters, you remember what he said? He talks specifically about Paul's writing, if you remember. Yeah, he says, our beloved brother Paul, who's written to you about these things in many words, some of which are hard to understand, which the unbelieving rest to their own destruction as they do the rest of the scripture. So you've got Peter and Paul, who at one point were probably in Rome together, who were working together, who knew of each other, who read each other's letters, and there is a good relationship there between them. And I think that's an important point to make. As we go through and look at this, Peter is no longer really going to be the focus in this book. Now it's going to be Paul moving forward, but Peter's still active and working, as are the other apostles. We simply don't read about them because that's not the point of the book of Acts. So we have Silas, who is mentioned prominently. His name is, it's likely the Latin form of his Jewish name, which was Silas. Some people have even said it might be a version of Saul. We don't know that for sure. But he's going to be a very important part of what Paul's going to do in this ministry. So any comments, thoughts, or questions before I get moving? So we'll talk about the journey a little bit. And I'm going to kind of walk through some of these things, as I mentioned, as we kind of look at... Yep, done that. As I mentioned, this is how Paul's going to work. I wish I had a pointer, but he's going to go up this time from Antioch up through Cilicia, up through the church in Galatia. If you'll notice that, you can't probably read that, but Derbe and Lystra are going to be two of his first stops when he gets into that area. And what's the first thing that happens that we read about when he gets into Lystra? We get another new character, don't we? We get Timothy. I thought about talking a little bit about Timothy here, but there's so much that we could say. I'm not going to do that for now. We'll kind of revisit that a little bit. But Timothy becomes obviously one of the most important figures in Paul's life at this point. And Paul finds him in verse 1 and 2 of chapter 16. If you'll notice, in verse 2 it says he was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium, which tells us that, if you remember, it's probably been about 2 years or so since Paul has been here. Well, since that time, we've got Timothy, who would presume to have been converted in that first visit, is now not only faithful, but he is actively working in the church and in the gospel to the point where he's got people in other cities that know of him and are commending him for the work that he's doing. So he has established himself early on as an evangelist, so much to the point that when Paul sees him, he wants to bring him along, as opposed to John Mark. I did want to make another point. I'm sorry, I forgot one thing I wanted to say about John Mark, because we always leave John Mark here as being kind of separated from Paul. How did Paul view John Mark by the end of his life? Do we know? He was useful, wasn't he? I find this really ironic that when you look at the passage in 2 Timothy, in fact, if you look over in 2 Timothy, where this comes up, and remember what Paul's talking about here in the context of this, in in 2 Timothy in verse 9, 2 Timothy 4, verse 9, he says, "Do your best to come to me soon, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia. Luke alone is with me." So he's going through all this list of people who have turned away and gone. And what does he do? "Get Mark and bring him with me, with you, for he is very useful to me." I find that interesting. In a time when he's talking about all the people that turned back, he goes and says, "Go get the guy that turned back on mission one and bring him." So clearly, there's been a great change in Paul's attitude towards Mark. And of course, most observers believe, and several of the church fathers back up the idea that Mark eventually was the one who wrote the Gospel of Mark. So it's a great example of where we think about people who are young and kind of just getting started and not always making the right decisions and not always showing the kind of strength and favor and backbone that we want to see. You know, what's our response to that? We don't give up on them, right? We keep working because these are the people that can become foundational figures in the Lord's church. Reuben, did you have something?
Yeah, I was going to say that we don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe he repented. Maybe mm-hmm. he did something wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and he repented, and Paul forgave him and took him. So mm-hmm. we don't know.
Yeah.
Your position is okay, and mine is also, because we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, we have no idea what was the exact issue here. Mm-hmm. All we know is that later on he accepted him. So, you know, a lot of things could have happened.
Yeah. Yeah. There could have been any. Like we say, we don't know the reason that why John turned Mark turned back. But what we do know is that it was resolved by this time, and he had gained a level of trust with Paul that was very different and much greater. And so again, I think that ought to be a reminder of us for us and how we deal with young Christians and the patience that we need to show. And also for those who are young, you know, it's going to be a growing experience. You're going to make mistakes, but you keep going and you keep striving, and the idea is you continue to become more and more what you need to be, because you know, there's all kinds of things that we can accomplish as we grow in our faith. So I meant to make that point. So let's go ahead and get back where I was. They're moving into Lystra. Paul picks up Timothy, and if you'll notice in verse 3, he makes a point of circumcising Timothy. Now, why does he do this? Why did Timothy need to be circumcised here? Yeah, his father was Greek. Did I hear something else? Yeah. It's a question of influence. Maybe he didn't have to be circumcised so much as it was needful for him to be. It was useful for him to be circumcised. His father was a Greek. His mother was a Jew. You know, if he's going from synagogue to synagogue, first of all, can he even go into the synagogue at this point? If you're not circumcised, you can't go into the synagogue anyway, and that's going to be a major part of all the things that Paul's going to be doing. He's still going to be appealing to the Jews. Now, you know, how do the Jews feel when they see someone who was a Jew and is refusing to honor the traditions that they have been brought up in? For right or for wrong, how is that person going to be viewed?
With suspicion.
Absolutely. In fact, and we'll see this later on when Paul goes back and visits with James at the end of his third journey when he's in Jerusalem. And James says, "Look, we've got a problem. We've got a lot of people who have been told by you that you're going around telling Jews that they shouldn't be circumcised and that they should not honor any of the traditions of the elders or any of the traditions of the law." And so he asks him, in fact, go into the temple and participate with this vow that these two are going so that they'll know that there's nothing to that. Now, he's not saying, we want to make sure that you're, that everybody knows you're still under the law. What he's still, what he's saying there is that, that you still honor your heritage, that you still honor these things that, that are part of the Jewish culture and upbringing. You're not just telling people to turn away from them immediately and just cast them aside as if they were nothing. And so in Timothy's case, he says it's going to be, it's going to be best for our teaching for you to do this. Now contrast that with what we alluded to last week with Titus. You know, when people wanted Titus to be baptized, to be circumcised, what was the response? No, absolutely not. Because there was no reason to it, to do it, other than it was a compromising of the gospel to say that a Gentile had to make himself like a Jew in order to be saved. So there's two very different questions that are being addressed, and two very different issues. And if you remember what, you know, Paul says this over and over in his own letters, I become all things to all men so that I may win Christ. I don't want to have a stumbling block. If this is going to be something that people are going to be upset about, then let's just take it off the table right now. But he would not do that when it compromised the truth of the gospel. And I think that's a good example of us when we think about passages like Romans 14. When it says, in fact, look over real quickly what it says in Romans 14 and verse 1. Actually, I think Timothy and Titus are probably a great example of this. He says in verse 1 of Romans 14, as for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrels over opinions, not for doubtful disputations. In other words, we're going to accommodate conscience until the point where it starts becoming an issue of division and selfishness and ungodliness and false teaching. And that's when, you know, that's when we stop accommodating those things. And I think that's Timothy and Titus is probably a good example of the difference between those two things. Does that make sense? So he takes Timothy and he has him circumcised in verse 3, and as they go on, as you remember, they're going through this area, Phrygia and Galatia. And where's Paul want to go? What apparently is in his mind at this point? He does eventually want to go to Rome. But even before that, I think we can assume that he wanted to go to Asia, because what do we see in verse 6? They're going through Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. Now again, as Reuben said, why? Don't know. But what we do start to see in this trip is you start looking at all the things that he accomplishes because he could not go to Asia. You know, he's going to be guided by the Spirit all the way over to Troas. And when they get to Troas, anybody remember who they met in Troas? We're not told specifically, but there's a little bit of a subtle hint to it. Who joins the party in Troas? Yeah, Luke. And the only reason we know that is because the he changes to we when they leave Troas. Luke keeps himself out of the story as much as he can. But there's a couple of times where you read through Acts and all of a sudden the pronouns change. Well, that's because Luke has now joined the group. We don't know a lot about Luke's background, but we know he was most likely a Greek who had been converted, maybe by Paul. We're not told for sure. But whatever it is, when he got to Troas and then leaves to go down into Macedonia, Luke is now going to be with them for a good portion of those trips. So it says they go down to Troas, Paul gets his vision there, a man from Macedonia standing there urging him, saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And it says, immediately we sought to go up in verse 10 into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. So when we talk about Macedonia, can anybody come up with a couple of cities that we might know that are prominent in that region? You're probably not going to be able to read the map, so don't worry about it. Philippi is a big one, right? Philippi, what's another one? Thessalonica. Yeah, we might not necessarily associate Thessalonica as much. Philippi is a little bit more direct. But Philippi and Thessalonica are going to be two of the major cities, and of course also in Berea, that are going to be in this region. So, for example, when Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 8, remember when he says, I want to commend to you the generosity of the churches in Macedonia. We think, well, what is he talking about? What churches is he talking about there? Well, this is them. There may have been others as well, but specifically Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, and some of the other groups there. And if you remember, when we think about Paul's relationship with the Philippians. And he talks about this in the Philippian letter. In fact, if you go over, let's go to Philippians 4 and verse 14. If you'll notice, it's kind of personal comments to the Philippian church here. There's a couple other things he says that we'll talk about later in Philippians, but in Philippians 4, notice down in verse 10, where it says, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. He goes down to verse 14, yet it was kind of you to share my troubles. And you Philippians yourself know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving except you only. Even in Thessalonica, you sent me help for my needs once and again. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that increases to your credit. There's a generosity of spirit that they had in Philippi and some of the other churches in Macedonia. And what we learn from this is, if you remember how Paul describes them in 2 Corinthians 8, what was their financial, what was their economic status if you were going to describe the Macedonians? It wasn't much. They were poor, he says. But he said they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us. And by the way, the reason I bring a lot of these things up, you might be thinking, well, aren't we studying Acts? Why are we talking about Philippians and Thessalonians? The reason I do this is because when we read the book of Acts, people will look at the book of Acts and say, well, that's just some guy writing some things, and there's no, you know, how do we know any of this is true? What is the corroboration? And we'll mention some historical things that will line up with Acts, but one of the most important things to do or to notice is that when you read Paul's epistles, which are independently written, which are separate from them, you see over and over Paul referring back to the things we read in Acts. And you start to see some of the context of what's going on. We talk about, for example, Paul's in Corinth for almost 2 years. We don't know a lot about what he's teaching. But then we go read 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, and we start to see some of the things that were going on, some of the issues that he was facing, and some of the topics and some of the concerns and some of the struggles that they were having, that were having to be addressed even after he had been there for 2 years. I do this really as much as anything to make sure that we understand that this book is not just an assemblage of facts. This is the life of Paul and the work that he was doing. And when we read his letters to these people, to these churches, there's real connections here. We especially see that in Thessalonians and Philippians, I think. He'll talk about the events that were going on while he was there, describing how he sent Timothy to them, and Timothy's report back to them. We'll see that a little bit in some of the accounts. He talks about how the Philippians are having to go through persecution and difficulty, and they're going to have to suffer to get into the kingdom of heaven. You know, these are people that watched Paul get beaten and thrown into jail by the Philippian government. They know firsthand what it means for Paul to say that he's suffering. So when Paul writes them from the jail in Philippians, it's almost like they read it and go, well, Paul's in jail again. You know, we've seen that before. And he says, that's all right, because that's what's going to happen. That's what it means to be a Christian. And that's how you're going to have to live. And that's kind of the point that he makes for them as well. So that's kind of why I try to make some of these connections. So we get into Philippi. It is the first basic, the first main city in Macedonia that we read about him staying. And it goes back to what we talked about earlier. Let's skip through here because I want to get to this. We talked about the 7 individual conversions that we read about in the book of Acts, and we've gone through 5 of them, but now we've got one more, which is the woman in Philippi, who is Lydia. And what do we know about Lydia? We don't know a lot about her, but we know a couple of things. She's seller purple, which probably means she has a person of some means, I would assume.
She's from Thyatira.
Yeah, she's from Thyatira. And how is she described? When it says in the last thing it says about her in verse 14.
She was a worshiper of God. Opened her heart to
pay
attention to what was said by Paul.
Yeah, she's a worshiper of God. Now, again, this is a slight assumption, but I think it's a safe one. If she had been a Jew, likely he would have said that she was a Jew. The fact that he says she was a worshiper of God is kind of like how you would refer to Cornelius. This is someone who's probably a Jewish proselyte, somebody who believed because she's at the house of prayer with everyone else, or the place of prayer, I should say. I think we talked about this, the synagogue rules. You have to have at least 10 adult Jews in a city to have a synagogue. They either didn't have that, or they had that, but they didn't have the money to build a synagogue, which is also possible. And so they were assembling by the river. Paul goes and finds them, and Laura's point is really good. It says that the Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was being said. Well, that, what do we mean by that? How does the Lord open someone's heart?
Makes you receptive.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Now, I want you to notice something. Because people will, of course, go to this passage and say, well, there you go. She didn't, it wasn't about her listening. God forced her to listen. God forced her to care. What do we already know about before Paul even gets here? What is her status? She's a believer in God. She's a worshiper of God. She's already there. She already has a heart that is attuned to hearing God's word. Now, Luke uses a really similar language to this back in Luke 24. If you remember on the road to Emmaus, when Jesus is talking to his disciples or his apostles, and it said he opened their hearts. You remember how he did that? He did it by teaching them. He did it by showing them the scriptures. And I would suggest that's exactly what Luke is talking about here. Lydia's heart is open because Paul appeals to her from the scriptures, the ones that she already believed, and said, I want to show you how these things lead us to Christ. And we see that her heart was good, her heart was open, and we read that after she was baptized, she actually asks, she asked to host them. It says in verse 15, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. And she prevailed upon us. We talked about the unique lessons that it seemed like each one of these conversions give us. And if I were going to look at this one and say, well, what do we learn from this? I think what we learn is that the gospel finds those people who have open hearts. People who are willing to listen will hear the gospel and they will respond to the gospel. And I think the reason that's important is to make sure that we don't get discouraged when we talk to people about God. Because we're going to get told no over and over and over and over again. And it's very easy for us to say, well, maybe there's something wrong with the message. Maybe we need to be presenting it better. Maybe this is just not appealing. Maybe we need to find a shortcut. Maybe if we start appealing to people in worldly things, maybe if we offer to pay their bills or feed them or do these different things and kind of lure them in a little bit, and maybe we can get the gospel in at some point later on. Well, I think what this passage tells us is that the one who wants to believe will believe. The one who wants to accept the word of God will accept the word of God. And our job is to teach the word and then to move on, which is exactly what Paul and Silas are going to do through their lives. We mentioned the characteristics of the different conversions. As we talked about, conversions in a lot of ways in the book of Acts are, you can compare them to points on a map, that you've got different details given to different people at different points in their faith. We see some who, you know, they saw, they heard, they believed. As Simon's case, they were baptized, they continued with the disciples. We start to see abbreviated versions of that same idea. They're not always the same. And here we got a relatively short one as well. What do we see? We see Lydia hearing, we see her being baptized, and we see her continuing with her association with the disciples. There's nothing about believing, but obviously that's a clear implication, isn't it? So again, you're seeing this pattern, but you're not seeing anything new being introduced. It's the same ideas. There's no speaking in tongues. There's no baptism of the Holy Spirit. There's no miraculous gifts or anything like that. There's simply this idea of hearing the word and being convicted by it and responding in obedience to the gospel. And I think, and we'll see that with the Philippian jailer, of course, when we get to that, which we're probably not going to have time for today. So, let's see if there's anything else I want to talk about here. And that's where we'll stop. So we'll talk about the Philippian jailer in Thessalonica and move into Corinth after that. Thank you for your attention.